All right, so welcome. How's that volume? That sounds good. Okay, good. So tonight I'd like to talk about befriending the hindrances. Befriending the hindrances. So just out of curiosity, did anyone feel any sleepiness in this last meditation? Yeah? Go and raise your hand. Anyone have any experiences they didn't particularly like that they kind of wanted to rather not have? Yeah? Anything that they liked? Or wish we were a little different? Right? Any sense of like agitation, like you couldn't sit still, the mind was really busy? Did that happen for anyone? A few people, right? Any sense of I'm not quite sure if I can do this, if I can sit through this whole period, if I'm up to the task, any of that come up? Yeah? Yeah, so notice how this is not a unique situation. We tend to take these as being very personal, that there's something wrong with me. I'm sitting here and everyone else is like as still as the Buddha. And my mind is just like going everywhere. I want to shift. I want to fall asleep. Right? What about in your life today, at work or at home? Any of those patterns of mind come up too? Anything that you didn't like happen, that you wish were different, or you wish that something was pleasant would continue? Any sense of sleepiness or spaciness, any doubt? So it's not, these hindrances aren't just exclusive to what happens in meditation. We just happen to notice it because we're being quiet, we're paying attention. But these are actually going through our system all the time. These are common patterns that we all deal with. So these five hindrances, just to name them, there's craving, the sense of moving towards something, that sense of wanting something to be, something to continue that's pleasant, that leaning into the moment. There's aversion, the sense of moving away from experience, from the unpleasant. There's sleepiness, or often called sloth and torpor, the sense of drowsiness, lack of energy. Those are common states too. Restlessness and worry, the sense of not being able to sit still, the sense of anxiety. And then doubt. A sense of confusion, not sure, you know, where am I standing? What direction should I go? Should I even be in this place? So these are the five hindrances. So how do we befriend them? How do we turn them from this obstacle that we can overcome to something that actually deepens our practice, serves us in our spiritual journey? The first step is to start to take them out of the personal, to stop thinking it as something that's I've failed or something wrong with me because this hindrance is arising. To realize they're just like weather systems that go through the mind. And there's a certain condition, like to rain in Seattle like it did a few days ago, you gotta have certain conditions, enough moisture, particles in the air, the right kind of whatever happens for it to happen. When those conditions came together, we get precipitation. And the same thing with our own minds and our own bodies. When the right conditions are present, then these different hindrances arise. Okay, so it's not your fault that they're arising. You know, you can't control the circumstances. Has anyone found out a way to prevent those from arising? Can I get the conditions just right so you never experience another hindrance ever again? Right? That would be nice. But when you realize it's outside of your control, you start to realize it's not your fault. It's not your fault that, okay, my mind is sleepy, I'm falling asleep, or I'm restless, or I'm really stuck in this fantasy. So it doesn't mean that you're remedial or you're a failure. And so it's important to realize adding self-judgment to a hindrance is completely unnecessary. It really adds to our suffering. And this added suffering is a lot of what the Buddha focused on. What do we add to the already suffering that we have? What do we add to that that creates more and more suffering? And is that optional? Is there a way to release that? Now, if you do like to judge yourself, like I do, and it's really a good way to give yourself a multiple hindrance attack, all right? So I'm sitting here in meditation, I'm starting to feel sleepy, all right? Why am I feeling sleepy? You know, why can't I be more alert? Okay, I've added aversion to sleepiness. And I start to think, wow, you know, the meditation just started. I've been practicing for so long. I'm adding restlessness and worry. more and more thoughts around this experience. So I've taken sleepiness, added aversion, added restlessness and worry, right? Then I start to feel a sense of, wow, what can this be like that sitting last week when I just felt as still as a pond? So we've added craving, right? And then finally, you know, maybe I'm just not up to this. Maybe I should go back to my other activities, or just, you know, put my zafu in the cushion in the closet and forget about it. So now I've added doubt. So you can see how very easily, if we relate to the hindrances in a certain way, we can quickly create more and more hindrance, more and more aversion, more and more craving, restlessness to this already difficult situation. The hindrances seem to be part of being human. I mean, the Buddha was talking about them 2,600 years ago. So it's part of this human mind, this human body that tends to have this relationship to life. We notice it in meditation because we're paying attention, but they're also always there in daily life. You know, so you can use the same things we're going to talk about in daily life, not to use that outside, keep that outside of your meditation, but bring daily life into your spiritual practice. So tonight I'd like to explore how we can understand these hindrances more and really how to befriend them, how to stop making this obstacle. The very word hindrance sounds like it's something in our way, right? It's something I have to overcome. So already we're set up in kind of this adversarial relationship to this part of our experience. So as soon as we feel that sense of separation, that sense of this is not what I want to be, I'm going the wrong direction. The Dharma is this path of learning to open to all aspects of ourselves, all aspects of our experience. So there's not a sense of, okay, this is the good pile and this is the bad pile, but this very fundamental changing of our perspective with how we experience and relate to life. So these weather systems move through us, and having a way to work with them skillfully is very helpful. We'll talk some about those. But mostly I want to focus on this ultimately this full embrace of them, this full acceptance of this experience. And so we don't apply a hindrance to the hindrance. We don't apply aversion to aversion. So can we approach it in a different spirit? So now I'm going to go through the five hindrances and see if that helps us understand them. Then we'll go into a different way to work with them. So craving, the sense desire. So this is this leaning into the moment, leaning into this experience. Okay, I really am enjoying this meditative experience. I'm enjoying this relationship, this taste I'm having. And you want it not to move. You don't want it to leave. Or it can also show up when we're sitting and having perhaps a difficult time and we want to go into fantasy, lean into, oh, next week I'm going on vacation. That's that leaning into our experience. Think of Gollum in the Lord of the Rings, when he's got his ring and he's just like, oh, my precious. There's that sense of just so absorbed in this pleasant experience, that it's so happy to have this while it's present. And a good cross-check, if you ever wonder if you're caught in craving or craving is present, is what happens when that experience ends? You know, what happens when that ice cream cone falls over or is gone? You know, is there a sense of tightening of the heart, tightening of the body, that leaning into, oh, I wish I had that more, if that would keep lasting? There's a sense of grief, sense of loss or anger. And you know, aversion, or not aversion, but craving was present to some degree. Now the shape of the mind, the way that this weather system affects who we are, how we perceive the world, I consider the shape of the mind, the way we actually perceive life. The Buddha had a set of very nice analogies to this. He says, imagine a bowl of water. When it's completely clear, we can see our reflection very easily, undistorted. There's a clear seeing and a clear reflection back. Now, when craving is in that system, it's like someone's dropped dye into that, and it's colored the water. perhaps, you know, green or red or something like that. So that everything that we see, everything that's reflected, is influenced by that dye. You get a sense of how craving starts to really influence us. So next time you find yourself in craving, notice how this becomes such a priority, this whatever you're leaning into. Okay, if I can just have this experience. Now, what is the source of that dye? You know, what is the dropper that brings in and colors it? Often it is this deep inner sense of lack, that there's something unfulfilled in our lives. That if I can only have this experience, this relationship, this object, then that lack will somehow be fully filled, be released finally. And this is kind of the tale that craving tells us. If you just get that right thing. If you don't have that yet, you just haven't found the right thing yet. Right? You can just keep looking. All you have to do is look at the advertisement, and there's always the new things. This will make you happy finally. You know, I'm not complete without that extra experience, that extra thing. I was on a metta retreat with Sharon Salzberg this couple weeks ago. And you know, we repeat the phrases, may I be happy, you know, may I be safe, may I be free. So after a while, after doing this for a few days, I started to notice that sense of being happy, that, you know, may I be happy, I started noticing the different choices that would come up, going down a thought train that led to more contraction, more self-judgment. And I realized this isn't choosing to be happy. It's like this big background intention to be happy started to shift that intentionality. So I could say, well, this just doesn't lead to happiness. So we start to work with craving in that way, that realize what we chase after is not where happiness really resides. And we see that for ourselves, and then things start to loosen up in a very fundamental way. Now working with craving, with sense desire, there's kind of a combination of strategies. One is this know of love, the sense of, okay, I'm just not going to go down that path anymore because I've gone down it so many times. That sense of, okay, I'm going to draw this line here. So there's a sense of resolve, a sense of holding the integrity. But also we need a sense of a great sensitivity of investigation. This willingness to see these very subtle ways that craving manifests, and very subtle ways that we're trying to fulfill that craving. You know, there's deeper needs, there's deeper unmet wants. So the sensitivity is, if we were too harsh with it, just cut it off, we don't see all of those, and we don't learn about ourselves in that way. Because if we follow craving, if we listen to that, so what I mean by follow it, let's say there's an impulse to act on some craving, and I decide to just be still with it, just to sit in the middle of it and experience it fully, right? So what am I really leaning forward? What do I expect to get from this experience? And if I'm quiet and follow that question down deeper and deeper, I start to touch into these deeper unmet wants, these needs, often have an archaic origin. Archaic meaning our family of origin, how we were parented, you know, the different traumas we've had, the different hurts we've had, the ways we just weren't met the way we wanted to be or needed to be. So there's this need to try to fulfill that deep hurt. Right? So when we realize that, then we realize, oh, this chasing this item, this experience, this person, is never going to fulfill this deeper pain. And the path is clear that I need to attend to this deeper pain. And this falls away. And if we go even deeper with craving, we start to see that this very root of it is this craving to be, the craving to actually take form, to take identity, to say, this is who I am, this is where I am. And it's a very deep hunger, a very deep sense of craving. So being very subtle, very quiet with that, very gentle with it, you start to see that, the inclination to become. And in that subtleness, you can start to see, is that helpful? Does that really lead to suffering, or to the end of suffering to do that? So aversion. So this is the leaning away from our moment's experience, what's happening in this moment. I'd rather not be having this particular traffic jam. this particular pain in my body. Think of Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh, you know, for a kind of a depressive personification of this. And everything is faulty in the world. In some ways, we can say it's opposite of craving. It's the movement away from experience into the moment toward it. But in other ways, we can see it as part of the same phenomenon, different sides of the same coin. Right? So one we're moving toward, one we're moving away, but there's still this quality of moving with relationship, and that we're moving with that. And just as with craving, if we follow the deep roots, you see these archaic pains, archaic hurts, and underneath the hunger to not be. There's some of these the fundamental causes of suffering if you follow the Four Noble Truths and the Second Noble Truth. Now, the Buddha talked about the sheep of the mind when in this bowl of water analogy. In this case, the water is boiling. Right? So you can imagine the boiling water, how that distorts our image, how we see the reflection. So our mind is boiling with aversion, with a sense of unease, this sense of not wanting this experience, not wanting this person to be in front of us, not wanting this traffic jam. If you turn into aversion, it really feels like that. The body is just like just boiling with unexpressed anger or unexpressed energy. So as we work with aversion, there's many ways we can work with it, but one way is just to start to connect with where is the base of this fire? Where's the core piece of this fire that's making the water boil? So we start to direct our attention to that part of ourselves. And what's the hurt part that I can connect with? And then again, as we connect with that, then the aversion itself, the actions from aversion start to fall away. We have a very different relationship to it. So if you ever wonder, am I having aversion right now? Good cross-check is to notice what happens when that experience ends. Is there a sense of, oh, okay, relief? Anyone ever feel any relief when the bell rings at the end of a meditation? Right? You know, perhaps there's a sense of aversion that was building up. You know, sitting still for a while, your body starts to get achy. And it's not about judging the fact that aversion is arising. So judgment is another form of aversion, right? It's okay just to notice it. Just, okay, this is how I'm relating to life in this moment. So befriending the hindrances is not about pushing them away, denying them, stopping them from arising, but really embracing them, you know, befriending them. So not to judge when aversion or craving arise, but just to really notice it. So the next hindrance is sleepiness, or I like the classical sloth and torpor. It's the only chance I get to say torpor, or sloth for that matter, and this is this context. So we can look at sloth and torpor as being this imbalance of energy in our system. Too much calm, too much tranquility. So we're almost don't have enough energy to really pay attention. So the range of experience, as I'm sure you're very familiar, can be a sense of sinking mind, just kind of daydreaming, not really knowing where you are, to outright falling asleep, to snoring. Now the analogy the Buddha used for this one is the bowl of water now is filled with algae, right? So that's how it feels. If you're meditating and you're falling asleep and you're resolved enough not to get off the cushion, but to actually be with that yourself and that experience, it's like everything's closing down. It's hard to see. It's hard to have much perception of what's going on. You know, this bowl is choked with algae. So it needs a sense of refreshing, a sense of arousing the energy, recirculating it. So things have become too stagnant. You know, a very simple, it's basically we start to arouse our energy in the midst of the sleepiness. We can open our eyes, we can sit up more upright, we can make our mindfulness more exact, we can stand up. And that's often we're kind of hesitant to make a big scene by standing up. Christina Feldman, I was assisting her at a retreat a few years ago, and she said she always feels like applauding when someone stands up. And it's like, wow, you know, they're choosing to be alert. Yeah, because it takes a little courage to stand up in a meditation hall. But it's completely acceptable. It's really this commitment to be awake. Now, sloth and torpor, I often feel like there's these two causes. There's a primary cause and a secondary cause of why sloth and torpor arises. So first cause, the primary cause, I grew up in New Mexico in Albuquerque. So the climate was such that we'd have these little dust devils. So think of a small tornado, but you know, really small. So it would kick up maybe as tall as this building or twice as tall as this building, kicking up dust and debris, you know, tumbleweeds. And then sometimes it would just stop. It would live only for maybe 30 seconds or a minute, and then the wind would stop. But all the debris would start to fall down. And that's kind of how I see sloth and torpor when it arises in this primary way, is that we go through life not sleeping enough, being stressed, with grief that's unfelt, pushing ourselves very hard. And this is the dust devil kicking up all this debris. As long as we keep moving, we don't really notice it. We say, okay, let's sit quietly for a few minutes, for a half an hour. And suddenly the wind starts to cut, and all this debris falls down. That's a quality of sleepiness that's raining down on us. So it's like we're connecting with what actually we're carrying with us all the time. So you can see that in retreats, there's often the first day is a lot of sleepiness as people are trying to readjust for their deficit of sleep. So if sleepiness is a big reoccurring thing for you, just to notice how much am I pushing myself? How much am I denying the needs for sleep? I remember Ellen saying once in a beginning class, this young man came up at the end and said, you know, this class has changed my life. And she asked why, and she said, well, at the beginning, Rodney said to get 8 hours of sleep, and I did, and my life has completely changed because of that. Right? So we also have to take care of this body, take care of our needs. Now, the secondary cause, this is the sense of like a defense mechanism. You know, what's arising? Because meditation starts to make the unconscious more conscious, right? And so sometimes what's being seen is more than we want to see at this moment. We have so much resistance or aversion to it. Our defense patterns are so well ingrained that we'd rather check out than see it. We'd rather go to sleep than experience it. So in high school, I was a competitive swimmer. And before a meet, I would always fall asleep. Like taking the bus to the meet, I would just sleep because I was so nervous. So instead of feeling the nervousness of it, I would go to sleep. So next time you find yourself being sleepy, a good question just to ask is, what would I be feeling if I wasn't sleepy? You know, what would I be feeling if I wasn't sleepy? And sometimes it's nothing. And sometimes you start to touch into perhaps some grief or some sadness, some fear. It's something that just is not fully acknowledged. And notice if you connect with that, what happens with the sleepiness? Is it still present? So restlessness and worry. So for years, I just kind of focused on the sense of restlessness, how the body just can't sit still, it's like shaking, wants to move. But worry is also a very important component of this. So you can take aversion, for example, or craving, and you add more and more thoughts around it, adding papancha to this experience. And this is what creates the sense of worry. We call it anxiety nowadays. Now, the bowl of water now is rippled by the wind. It's just churned up by the wind. So it's not boiling like it is in aversion, but it's so disturbed by the wind that's going across it, you don't get a clear experience. You don't see what's really happening. So starting to quiet the wind is one strategy to start to need to make your practice very simple, you know, not to make it complex, just a sense of grounding in the body, grounding in the breath, opening up the field of vision or sound so it's not so contained in what's creating that. Also sometimes going the other way, giving an outlet for the energy can be helpful. Suzuki Roshi use an analogy of a stallion, which was wild and unbroken, and you put it in the small stall, it's going to kick and buck and cause all kinds of damage to the stall and to itself. And so often with our own experience, we try to contain it, keep it tight. But you take that same stallion and put it out in this big open meadow, it'll kick and buck, but eventually start to calm down. So restlessness, we can do the same way. It's like we're feeling all this restlessness, going exercising, moving, you know, really getting your heart rate up can help dispel that energy, and there can be a calm that arises after that. And I think there's also primary and secondary causes of restlessness. So the primary cause is almost this unhooking of these tension patterns. And we carry so much physical tension, mental tension, emotional tension, psychic tension. And as we really relax into our experience again and again, that starts to unhook. And sometimes that unhooking causes this release of energy. So if it's manageable, just trying to sit still in the midst of it can be very helpful to let it find its own path out to find the blockages that need to be released. You know, so the body can tremble, can shake a little bit. But there's also a secondary cause, and this is adding something to our experience. Okay, this is too much, I don't want to deal with this. That sense of added experience, added tension to this moment, tension with what's in our experience. Well, how I should be in this moment, well, how I shouldn't be in this moment. So again, ask yourself, what would I be feeling if I wasn't feeling restless? Just to kind of highlight that and see if something floats up. So you're gonna, when you ask those questions, you ask them and then you just listen. You just listen and let things arise. So the final one is doubt. So as a hindrance, it unplugs our energy. It's like someone pulling the circuit breaker, pulling out the power strip and everything goes out. We just lose our energy to practice. We don't believe in our capacity to practice, the teacher's capacity, the tradition's capacity. And we also get confused. We don't know what's true, what's untrue, what's important to us. So in this case, the bowl of water is choked with weeds and muddy and in the dark. All right? So when you're really caught in doubt, it's like you just don't know which way to go. The Buddha talked also about this hindrance of doubt as being lost in the desert. That there's mirages that you can see. Was that water? Is that a tree? Or is it just an illusion? And which way do I go to escape this? And doubt, when it's really strong in us, can feel like that. So having a sense of patience is really helpful when doubt arises. And also getting some kind of support. You can look at the three refuges of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha as a nice way to get support. You're finding a teacher, finding some input with someone who's gone further on the path than you to help. I'm feeling this experience of doubt or this not knowing this is the right path. And they can help guide you. You know, looking at the Dharma, the many writings, the suttas, ways to help inspire you, listening to a talk. And then Sangha, you know, finding commonality, people who are on the same path as you, to say, you know, I'm having this struggle. And they've most likely had it also. And doubt is also part of the spiritual path. You know, it's an essential part of it. We start off with this sense of enthusiasm, this sense of I'm really excited by this. But at some point we start to run into our own resistance, our own sense of unconsciousness, and we start to feel that sense of doubt. So it's actually a deepening of the practice when doubt starts to arise. And as we work with that and go through it, we start to deepen into our own direct knowing that's unshakable. So doubt becomes the pathway to confirmed faith. So these are the five hindrances. So Christina Feldman was talking about this yogi who was on a retreat with her. And on retreats, we ask people not to read or not to, you know, read things. But people like to, you know, they read little notices. And so this one yogi was reading about the fire extinguisher instructions. Right? Kind of desperate here. But the instructions said, direct the nozzle toward the source of the flame. And that, direct the nozzle toward the source of the flame. And for her, that really, it's like, wow, I've been misdirecting Which is my attention, my mindfulness. Where is the source of this flame? You know, can I perceive that? Can I turn my attention to that? So the same thing with the hindrances. Can we find the source of that? And years ago, I was actually a forest firefighter for a short period. And often we wouldn't have anything special other than a shovel and some dirt. Right? So you have a bunch of smoke and flames. If you just throw it at the flames and the smoke, it doesn't help at all. You have to walk around and see where the actual fuel is burning. Where's the source of that fire? And that's where you put the dirt to smother it. Right? But so often in hindrances and mind states which are difficult or pleasant, we find the smoke becomes a distraction. That's what we focus on. That's where we throw our attention, our dirt, our efforts. So with hindrances, I mean, they have a very strong physical component, they can, a sense of sensations, reactions, mental, emotional. It can be this very strong storm that goes through us. This is the smoke and the flames of that experience, at that state. And it becomes very convincing that this is where the problem lies. If we're convinced by it, then the solution is clear. It's like, okay, if the fire is here, this is the problem. The hindrance is the problem. Okay, I need to first for craving get rid of. I need to get the object of craving. For aversion, I need to get rid of the thing I'm averse to. For sleepiness, I need to take a nap, or check out. You know, restlessness or worry, I need to act and move around. I need to give up from the voice of doubt. So notice how the hindrances do have this impulse to move, to do something with them. Now if we look at, instead of where the source of the fire is, the source of the flames with the hindrance, we'll realize that often there's a sense of hurt, a sense of pain that's underneath all that. We're hurting in some way when we're experiencing a hindrance, often emotional, mental, or physical. It may not be recognized at all. Maybe unconscious. There's some of the common shapes are like, I'm not good enough, a sense of not getting what I want, loneliness, lack of control, not feeling safe. So if these are very core hurts in your core beliefs, and they're especially if they're unconscious, they create all this smoke and fire that we tend to take as hindrance. So really acknowledging that we are hurting, that we're having a difficult time. When a hindrance arises, just realize this is a difficult experience. You know, I'd rather not be having this. This is not what I want. I remember my daughter when she was sick, like nauseous and throwing up, and just holding her, and you know, she said, I don't like this, I don't want this to continue. But it's like she had to go through it. But there's a sense as a parent to be able to hold her in the middle of that dukkha, that sense of suffering. So we learn to do that for ourselves, to hold ourselves in our pain, in our dukkha, standing under our dukkha, as Philip Moffat often says, the strength to be in the middle of it. So often we try to get over the pain, over the hurt, before we really take it in, before we fully understand it, acknowledge it, experience it. Because if we don't fully acknowledge and experience it, then we're driven by it. Some of the metaphors that the Buddha understood that how deeply these hurt. And he talked about when we're caught in craving, it's like we're caught in a deep debt. That really beholding to this debt that we owe. You know, the quality of aversion. It's like being sick, caught by this deep illness that we just is so debilitating. A sense of sleepiness. It's like we're in a prison. We can't escape. Quality of a restlessness. There's a sense of being in slavery, that we can't have our own freedom. And finally, as I mentioned, with doubt, the sense of being lost in the desert. As you take these in, you just realize how painful it is to have a hindrance arising in you. So when we touch a difficult experience, you know, difficult pain, there's a certain resolve, a certain intention to be willing to meet it. But always we have to keep in contact with our own heart, contact with a sense of compassion. So if we have this sense of, okay, I'm going to sit with this no matter what, and I feel myself getting tighter and tighter around it, okay, I'm going the wrong way. And so letting the heart come into that, that sense of caring that it's difficult, caring that you're having a difficult time. And so if we start to find ourselves becoming too reactive to what's happening, our attention is out of balance. And so we need to find a way to rebalance it, to become more spacious. So it's important how we are mindful, how we perceive our experience does matter. We can't use our own background sense of self-aversion or self-hatred or punishing ourselves to find love, to find peace. Right? We have to have this sense of meeting our experience with this compassion. So often when things become too intense, some simple ways to balance it is to expand the scope of attention, to shift into like to sound or to sight. Just say, okay, I'm gonna let this intense experience, set it aside for right now. I'm not pushing it away, I'm not ignoring it, but I'm choosing to shift my attention to something that allows me to rest in that, feeling a part of my body that's comfortable, feeling a sense of sound. And that allows our attention to rebalance. So then we can just gradually go back to these difficult experiences. And when a mind state like a hindrance is present, it does an interesting thing to our thoughts, to our perceptions. Our perceptions and thoughts actually become co-opted by it, actually become shaped by the hindrance itself. That's why the hindrances are kind of, in some ways, very sneaky and difficult to work with. Because when we're caught in a hindrance, like aversion or craving, our very mind, the shape of our mind changes to accommodate that. So all the thoughts that we have, all of the emotions, the sensations, are going to be going back to reinforce that hindrance, reinforce the logic of that hindrance. Right? So we have to learn to have a sense of distrust, to not believe those thoughts so fully, to believe that there's a validity to them. And in the middle of it, we really take those thoughts as having the significance, the strong thing of I have to really act from and believe from. You could see this as some way the meaning of clinging is when we get so connected and caught in something. It's like we have this gooey substance on our fingers, and no matter how much we try to get it off, we just spread it more and more. Because the very hindrance itself is shaping our thoughts and our actions. We could say that the language of the hindrance is urgency. There's a sense of needing to act, needing to do something about this. We often call this the yogi mind, when on a retreat everything's so still and there's nothing much we've done, need to do, everything gets amplified. Because we've really honed this quality of mind that figures out what needs to be fixed in our life, what's the problems that need to be solved. So in a retreat, we take all that away. And so suddenly, you know, having the lights too dark or the temperature wrong becomes so important, right? As a retreat manager, like a Cloud Mountain, I would respond to yogi notes. And it'd be inevitably be a note like, okay, it's too hot. And there'd be like this urgency, okay, I gotta do something about this right now. But I would, because I was on a retreat, I would take some time to feel that sense of wanting to act from it. And then a little while later, there'd be another note saying, it's too cold. Right? So I started to realize, okay, these are different people that may not represent the whole. And that the urgency to act is just something that's added to it. And I can't act from wisdom through that urgency. So recognizing that urgency, being really willing to release the story because it's so convincing. So if the language of the hindrance is urgency, the language of mindfulness, of compassion is patience. A sense of, okay, I'm going to really meet this moment's experience without an agenda. Just this moment, just this one breath, this one moment's experience. Slowing down the need to act, to think, to speak. So when we recognize that a hindrance is going through our system, just be willing to start to suspend our endorsement of those thoughts that come from it. Usually a thought comes up and we say, okay, this is true, I need to act on this. But just suspend that a little bit. So we don't have to act right away to see how our thoughts become shaped, created through the hindrance. And to do this, we shift our attention to the actual experience of the hindrance in this moment. Shift from the personal meaning, oh, I'm such a bad meditator, oh, I'm just not cut out for this. Shift from all that, how everyone else is doing much better than me. Shift from all that to the actual experience of it. You know, feel it in the body sensations, feeling the quality of being pleasant or unpleasant, feeling the extra shape of hindrance. So this is following the Satipatthana's instructions, the foundations of mindfulness, learning to take a cling, relationship or experience we're clinging to, we're caught in, and shift our attention back to our body, to learn to unclench, to ungrip. So this isn't, don't do this with the expectation that if I do this, the hindrance will go away. That, okay, be peaceful and pleasant to be caught in aversion. It's actually, in some ways, you're stepping more unprotected into it. So it becomes more intense, but in a very primal way, in a very simple way, instead of all our kind of squirming and trying to move around it. It becomes, okay, I'm sitting in the middle of this. So this is what aversion feels like. This is what sleepiness feels like, what doubt feels like. You don't have to figure out the exact combination, but just to be willing to sit in the middle of it. It's really this quality of our relationship to our experience that matters. So as we start to do this, we're turning toward the hindrances really with a sense of welcoming them, a sense of complete opening to them, a full-hearted acceptance, and this is how my experience is in this moment. I mean, experience can't be anything other than it is in this moment. So when you learn to actually fully embrace it, a lot of your suffering falls away, a lot of your resistance. So much of the time we're trying to make life other than it is in this moment. If only it was different, only it was better, language of aversion, of craving, we create so much tension around that. So the sense of metta is a nice guide, the sense of friendliness, the willingness to stand next to this experience, to shift out of our thoughts of urgency, of needing to act. This requires us to surrender very fully and deeply into this experience. Ultimately, even surrendering the positionality of how I am in this. What I mean by that is usually we are relating to our experience. I'm having this experience. And a lot of times I'm working with trying to have a more healthy relationship to it. But eventually we release so there's not this distance of me having this experience to just the experience. Releasing the sense of positionality. And in this way, we start to transform the hindrance from this difficulty to be overcome to an actual teacher, something that we can turn toward and learn from. That a hindrance represents these signposts of where we're caught, where we're identified, where we're resisting experience in life. And this, the spirit of welcoming, of turning toward, is captured very well by Rumi in the guest house. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight, the dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. So just sit quietly for a moment or two. All right. And we have some time for some questions. If you could turn on the overheads. Is there any comments or questions or? Yes. Oh, good. I'm glad it was helpful. Yeah, Joyce.
You spoke about the desire to be relationships and the aversion to not be. Can you describe that feeling of the poem?
Sure. So the question is describing the hunger to be, the desire to be, and the desire not to be. So classically, just to frame it for a moment, you know, the hindrance of is really the craving for sense pleasures, you know, the aversion from unpleasant experiences. But it's part of the same spectrum if you look at the second noble truth of craving and the craving to be or to not to be. So what is that, what that experience feels like? Again, it's something that we have to see for ourselves, you know, what that really is like. But sometimes you can get a sense of it being this just this wanting to be seen in a certain way, to be perceived in a certain way, to have this, sometimes it's a sense of wanting to have this sense of achievement or a sense of skill set or having a particular relationship, you know, being a partner on this other side of it or being a parent. You know, these different qualities of roles we might take is often a, in some way, the more superficial way of seeing that. But we start to get down in a more really minute level, a very small level. When you start to have these senses of the self being less prevalent, being dropping away, and you start to notice, okay, what wants to reform, what wants it to reestablish itself. So you start to, as if you become very interested in that, become very still with it, you can just see there's this sense of wanting to become, to reform. And sometimes if it's more of a painful part, it's more of not wanting to form, wanting to escape from that, to dissolve or to run away. But there's that sense of wanting to relate to experience from a certain perspective of being or not being. And so this is a very subtle quality of just that forming or not forming. And then if you listen to it and attend to it, you start to see how that really is a sense of hunger. And then what happens if I don't do that? And sometimes there's a sense of fear that comes up, a sense of, okay, who am I going to be if I'm not, what's going to happen if I'm not in charge, if I'm not in control? So deep down, I think that's the source of probably all of our neuroses, our issues, our difficulty, is that need to want to be something. So it can be that subtle hunger to want to form, and then we, you know, enlarge it as that, okay, I want to be, you know, a CEO, or I want to be this or that, or I want to have this, and what that means to be the person who has that new car or that new experience. But if we don't get distracted by the shape of it, the details of it, and we start to be very still with it, and you start to notice, you know, it goes down to that deep level. So it's an invitation to see, you know, see for yourself. So you can start off just that, okay, I want to be in this role, I want to be seen this way, or I don't want to be in this role, you know, both directions. Be still with it and just notice the movement of that. You're welcome. Yeah, Moffat. The conviction of thought.
Yeah. I believe when I think it's like this, it's going to be important to have all of this figured out.
So the comment, if I understand it right, is, you know, why is kind of the conviction or the belief in thought not a hindrance, while doubt is kind of in some ways the opposite of doubt? And we have to ask the Buddha to know why, for sure, why that was edited or changed in that way. I think but it shows up in other ways. You know, we could say that it shows up in craving and aversion. Because when you look at when thought is really enticing and really that's where I orient my life, sometimes when you notice, okay, I really like this opinion I have. I know I'm right. This time I really am right. All right. So just if you can notice that when that energy comes on, can I be a little more spacious with it? It's like I'm not, because usually we see it and we judge it and we try to change it. It's like we're altering it already. But if we can allow it to be just as it is without having to change it, we can start to really observe it more fully. And in that observation, you start to see that there's actually a quality of craving there, or a quality of aversion, or restlessness and worry. So in some ways, I would say that our relationship to thought is more of a bigger manifestation of the hindrances. I mean, certainly if you look at the Four Noble Truths, you know, it shows up too, that sense of really believing in our thinking mind. I mean, the Buddha didn't, I mean, he talked about thought, but not the same way that we take it as so central to our lives. He talked about it a lot, but not as much as Western teachers have to talk about it. And it could be just the Western mind is more complex. It's more psychological. You know, it's a cultural phenomenon, the way we relate to our minds. I think Ajahn Chah was kind of, in some ways, complaining about Western students because he says you guys are like carrying these libraries around your head. You got too much clutter in there. And, you know, like someone who hasn't gone through school has a more simple relationship to life, there's not quite so much clutter. So it's a challenge, but I mean, I like the idea of making that the sixth hindrance. That would be a good talk, the sixth hindrance. I'll credit you. Yes. So this distinction between craving and inclination. Well, a lot of it is the sense of what happens when that doesn't happen. You know, it's like you say inclination or a sense of preference, you know, liking this or not liking this. But when that doesn't happen, how much of a reaction is there? You know, is if there's the more reaction is the more there's a sense of craving in that moment. Because craving has this sense, life has to look this certain way for me to be happy, for me to feel a release of my lack or of a sense of safety or peace or whatever it might be. It depends upon looking this certain way. You know, if I have this pleasurable experience, then I'll be happy. Now, with inclination, you know, again, it's all semantics, but inclination is kind of this, you know, I would prefer to be this way. I prefer to be, you know, comfortable, free of pain. But when I have pain, is it the end of the world? Do I get more and more upset about it? Okay, the more upset I get, I was, okay, there was a quality of I really wanted it to be this way. So you could say is that when I depend upon it or need it to be this way, that's more the sense of craving. Inclination is, yeah, that would be nice to have it that way, but I can go the other way too. That would be my sense. Questions or comments? Yes, Ed.
You mentioned sometimes judgment coming in and additional arrows or additional hindrances in building.
Right.
They're pretty much all there, and
Right.
One
yeah.
form or another, or and so I'm curious if you have any guidance on teasing them out or loosening them up sufficiently so it's not so strong.
Okay. So the comment is about when you have multiple hindrances happening, like I have a multiple hindrance attack, is there any guidance about teasing them apart or working with them? That's helpful. I would say that the teasing apart, again, because the way they shape our perception, it's like there's this underlying logic that everything tries to reinforce when a hindrance is there. And you have multiple hindrances, you have all these different system. So anytime the way you perceive things, the way you act, the way you look, the way you think is going to be distorted and affected by the hindrance. Basically, every thought becomes attached to the hindrance. Multiple hindrances is going to be, you know, more complex. So teasing it apart is likely to have, you know, more subtle qualities of the hindrance. So when those happen to me, it's more like, okay, I'm just going to sit right in the middle of this. And so it's like feeling the waves as one becomes predominant. Okay, there's aversion. You know, just, and this isn't so much trying to label it exactly, but really feeling it, experiencing it. Okay, here's sleepiness. Okay, here's a big wave of restlessness when I feel like, you know, I'm going to explode. Okay, can I be still with that? And so it's this willingness to really sit in the middle of this storm. It's hailing, it's the wind blowing, trees are falling down. Okay, sit in the middle of that. And then through that resolve to sit in the middle of it, then things start to clarify a little bit. And you can start to see, okay, maybe there's this deeper root here that needs, then I can attend to that. But not to be distracted by trying to figure it out, but just to settle with it. Sometimes it's so intense, it's okay, what do I need right now? You know, maybe I need to exercise, maybe I need to open my eyes. So the way I described it first is really depend upon knowing when my attention is balanced. Okay? So if I start to pay attention and I get tighter around it, that's counterproductive, right? So you need to, you know, do something like stand up and move or do something, shift your attention. But if you know that, okay, my attention is balanced, I'm able to meet this. It's difficult, I have to really step up. But then it's like there's this, remember, you know, lava lamps? You know how they would kind of bubble up, and it's like as we settle and become quieter, like there's these parts of us that start to bubble up to be seen, to be experienced, and when it breaks the surface, that's the hindrance, the experience of the hindrance. If we kind of freak out about it, we're kind of shaking the lava lamp. But if we're able to be still with it, then it eventually dissipates. So the trick is not to be with it in the hope that it's going to dissipate. Because then we're kind of, you know, kind of white knuckling it, and you know, there's this conditionality to our attention. So it's that full embrace. Okay, this is going to be with me for the rest of my life. And if I really open to it in that way, paradoxically, it will last less. But if I open to it, I'm going to open to this for the rest of my life as long as it ends soon. then I'm using aversion to aversion. So it's really slippery, isn't it? It's very tricky. But you learned your way your mind works, the way that it tricks you, and how it, there's only so many patterns, so they become more and more familiar. It's like the Buddhists, you know, saying, you know, I see you, Mara. I see you in all your manifestations. I see you in this instance. And he wouldn't say, I see you and I hate you. It's like, I see you. And Mara says, oh, I'm seen. And go away. Yes. Yeah, Michelle.
Sometimes in our culture we refer to craving as motivation, and we think of it as a good thing that keeps us going.
Right, right.
So I always wonder, if we minimize the craving, where does the positive momentum come from instead?
The positive event or
positive
momentum.
Whatever. Yeah.
So the question is, in our culture, craving is often used to motivate action toward positive things. And if we release craving or work with it, what motivates us? What gives us the momentum? And it's a really good question. Because we go through life really the sense of, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to gain this experience. I'm going to, and we do a lot of good in life, really, right? you know, our, each one of us has, you know, our work or career or school, whatever shape that life has taken us, is often through that motivation of craving, really, if you look closely. But in spiritual practice, as we deepen into it, we do start to question, it starts to turn its sight, it's on its head. You know, really what motivates us. So sometimes there is this period where we kind of, what we usually have used to motivate us doesn't make sense anymore. And we're kind of in this no man's land of, okay, what is going to motivate me? And so that can sometimes be a difficult time in our lives, in our practice. But if we're able to work with that and move through that, something else starts to move us that's not based in craving. You can say in some ways it's more of this heart's intention. So imagine, like, let's say I really want to do some good in the world. I want to do something about global warming. Okay, so initially we might have a sense of craving, I have to do something about this. That's really urgency to act. Okay. And as we go through this process, we can have this sense of, okay, there's still the heart desire to act on this, to change this. But at the same time, there's also this holding the outcome really loosely. It isn't, you know, I have this intention to act, but the outcome, I'm able to hold that in a very balanced way, whether it goes the way I want or doesn't go the way I want. And that's really the difference, going back to the other question about inclination and craving, is like there's this agenda or this conditionality set to craving. Life has to look this certain way for me to be happy. This other quality that motivates us, you know, that really can say the heart, you can say emptiness, stillness moves us. It doesn't have this agenda that life look a certain way. It may have a clear inclination and intentionality, but if life changes a different way, it's still met very fully. So it's kind of mysterious. It's interesting what moves us, but it is different. It is different than our normal craving. You're welcome. Yes.
As you were talking, and previously when I've thought about hindrances, I've thought of them as hindrances to my practice.
Yes.
But then, as I was thinking about that, well, what does that really mean? Mm-hmm. Is that hindrance to a state of mindfulness, of concentration, of mm-hmm. stability of mind, of becoming an awakened person?
Right,
you know?
Right.
How do you see that in terms of, you know, like, the application of, you know, what the object of the hindrance
is. So the question is, the hindrance is often seen as this this barrier to our mindfulness, or our concentration, to awakening, and how do I see them in relationship to...
What is it a hindrance to?
Oh, what's a hindrance to? You know, in some ways, I would probably rename them, because when we say hindrance, we're already kind of set up in this. This is a problem I have to get rid of. It's, I mean, that's just what falls up when we say hindrance. And so, in that way, there's this way we're already kind of set at trying to stop it. Okay. But I think of the hindrances simply as, you know, at first, for a long time of practice, they are something that's like this barrier to being steady, to being having steady attention, to being present. There's something I'm trying to work with skillfully to overcome. But eventually you realize that tendency to want to overcome it is actually a very subtle form of hindrance in itself, a sense of preference. So I realize that eventually I have to be willing to turn toward the hindrance very fully. And then I start to realize the hindrance is actually just showing me pockets of resistance, pockets of identification, of holding, of gripping. And so, you know, I don't know what I would name them, but it's, I think eventually it changes from not being a hindrance to being like a guidepost, a place to pay attention, a chance to open to something that's unpleasant. And in that opening, I learned how to have this bigger capacity to meeting life. So that way the hindrances aren't become hindrances anymore. They just become life. And in the paradox is, once that you start to shift that way, the hindrances really start to quiet down. Because the hindrances get, the thing that keeps creating them is our reactivity toward them. Okay? I want life to be this certain way, and it's not that way. I rehearse that over and over again. That makes hindrance more likely to arise. But as I meet life, okay, this is how it is. I really, not intellectually, but really open with my body and my psyche to this experience, and there's not a resistance to it, something softens. And it's no longer feeding the roots of hindrance. All right, I think that's good for tonight. Now, do we have any announcements?